right, if everybody can start moseying back to their seats. I got to talking. It took longer than normal, but I don't think anybody cares. We'd all like to talk. As everybody's heading back to their seats, I'll just give a quick recap kind of what we went over last time. If you remember, we talked about the diaspora of how when the Jews went back home, they didn't all go back home. They kind of spread out all over the place, started setting up all these little city-states everywhere they went, and became really good at banking and commerce, and so they did really well for themselves. That's where they started building these synagogues. And so we talked about all of that. We also talked about so part of that diaspora, part of as they spread, the creation of these different groups, which we'll talk a little bit more about, several of the different groups of Jews, how we get this mindset that they were all the same, they were unified, but they were very segmented. They had different levels of religion as far as what they believed in. And so we'll talk about that a little bit. Anything else I want to recap? The last thing we talked about was kind of this intensity of hopping on board with any type of revolts. Because they knew that there was a Messiah coming. They knew that they were going to be restored to their land. Somebody was going to kick out the Romans. And so every time these little revolts kind of started building up, so they would get on board with these people and go, yeah, we're in favor of this. We know that this is a fourth empire. We know that we're going to be reestablished. We're going to be given our homes back and all the foreigners are going to be pushed out. So they were all up on all of these little groups that started these rebellions. And we'll get into that today because we'll talk, it has a significant impact even to our world today, even though we don't know too much about it. But it was all based around not only the return of the king, but also as that oral law spread. That was a big part of what we talked about, if you remember. The oral law was basically that protection. As they spread to all those other areas, they go, we don't ever want to go back into captivity. And so what they did was they created additional laws on top of God's laws so that you could never even get to God's law. They figured if we make this a law and you don't break that, then there's no way to break God's law. And therefore, we'll never go back into captivity. And so that's where we get today, because this is what I want to start out with. If you remember, I read this quote from Philo. I think I read it before I ended last time. But, okay, good. I'm not crazy. Because I didn't read it for Fort Wayne, but I thought I read it here. But I'm going to read it again, because this is what Philo writes pertaining to that idea of this oral law. It says, "For the man who obeys the written law is not justly entitled to any praise, inasmuch as he's influenced by compulsion and the fear of punishment." Now basically, if you're keeping the law, you're doing what you're supposed to, that's no big deal. You're just afraid of the punishment, right? Breaking God's law and burning in the lake of fire, not existing anymore. He goes, you're just afraid of that. And he goes on, basically, anybody can do that, even Gentiles. And he goes on and he writes, "But he who abides by the unwritten laws is worthy of praise as exhibiting a spontaneous and unconstrained virtue." He goes, you're so much better if you keep these oral laws, these unwritten laws. And so these were the traditions that were passed on from generation to generation. These were the discussions that the rabbis had as they would go on and try to figure out, okay, how do we not go back into captivity? Even though they were to some degree in captivity, right? The Romans ruled over them. The Romans had control. But he's basically saying, you're more righteous if you keep the oral law. So this is why we see this Pharisaical view, the Pharisees and the Sadducees battling with Christ all the steps of the way, is because they had this mindset of these laws are more virtuous than God's laws, which is scary to get into when we start to think about that, how we could make God's law better. All we do is make it harder. And that's what we see with the Pharisees and how they implemented this and what it was. Because they weren't always off base. When we think about some of the arguments that they made, we think about murdering, right? It's one of the Ten Commandments. Little guys, do you guys remember which one it is? Which commandments? Thou shalt not murder. Just yell it out. Are you sure? Oh, you were giving me a five. Is that, that wasn't a raised hand. My bad. Fifth. Yeah. Sixth. I say the fifth is parents. Fifth is parents. Come on, don't forget about me. That's, whose kid is that? What did Christ say about murder? He took it a step further, right? He taught us the spiritual element of it, which is what they actually believed. It's what they taught, that there was a level past that of we don't even hate each other. We don't have bad thoughts towards one another. And so some of these things Christ aligned with in his processing and the way what he taught. And so it starts to get this weird balance because their oral law sometimes looked like this. But what was Christ doing? He was making Jewish arguments. He was having Jewish debates, Jewish discussions, because he was dealing in a Jewish culture, a Jewish society. He was dealing with those people. Now, when we look at Paul, Paul was handling very different discussions because not only was Paul trained as a rabbi, but Paul was trained as a Greek philosopher. And there's points in the Bible where we actually, Paul is quoting Greek philosophers. As he's talking to other people, he's quoting people that they know. When we think about him talking about all the gods, because it puts in perspective sometimes how we're supposed to handle things. He's going, I see you guys are righteous. You guys are very righteous. You have a big faith. He goes, look at all these gods you have. And he gets all the way down to the unknown God. He goes, you guys have religion. He goes, but I want to tell you about this unknown God, because this is what you don't get. So he doesn't club them over the head and say, you guys are all pagans. These are all fake gods. They don't exist. You're evil people. Let me tell you about the true God. Now, they would have stoned him for that and beat him for that, because he's just bludgeoning them with truth. But he's graceful. He's tactful. He uses his education. He uses philosophy to say, hey, let me relate to you. I want you to understand me better. And he goes through this. And so we see different ways that the Bible works, because Christ was talking to a specific group of people. We even see the apostles at different times. The character traits that they had, they worked with different people. We see that in their writings, that they were focused on different groups. And so they wrote differently. They communicated differently. They had different problems because of that. And so we see how much the society and the culture and who they were dealing with plays into what they were teaching and what they were handling, some of the arguments that came about. And oftentimes when we go back and see when Christ is making these arguments and Christ is explaining what God's law is, they wanted to kill him because he wasn't living up to the oral law. He would jump straight over that oral law sometimes when it didn't actually coincide with God's law, and he'd go straight to the source and say, no, that's not what God teaches. He goes, this is what God teaches. He didn't cater to them. He didn't say, no, your oral law has validity. He goes, you don't understand the law. And he'd jump straight to God's law, and he'd teach from that. That's oftentimes why they wanted to kill him, is because he just pushed aside their tradition, their oral law, what they were doing, what they had created to protect their people. Because that's what they were doing. They were protecting themselves from ever going into captivity. And they have this man who's saying that he is equal to God, who spoke for God, and they didn't like that. And they were very upset about that. That's a lot of the Jewish history, but as we look at this more, as they come out of Babylon and get resettled back into where they go, oftentimes those struggles, as they're not wanting to go back into captivity, we think about how God worked with them, because they're now free, right? They get put back into society, they're starting to work through, try to figure out what's going on. You would think they'd be really dedicated to God, but they weren't. They were still somewhat wishy-washy about everything. They kind of baffled back and forth with what they were supposed to do. And we think about what Malachi would tell them at different times and the instructions that he'd give them and some of the post-exilic prophets of how they've tried to guide them and instruct them and lead God's people back on the right track. And they waffled at times. They just couldn't stick to it. Sometimes they listened. Sometimes they didn't. But then as we see these groups like the fathers, if you remember, the fathers is what turns into the Pharisees. They took it to an extreme. They listened, but they took it additional steps. And they go, okay, we're going to create more laws. We're going to protect God's law. And we're going to do all of these things. And so they did listen, but they just pushed it too far. So if we think about what happens in 332 with Alexandria, or Alexander the Great taking over the Persian Empire, he reestablishes the third empire of what we know. We see the development of two groups. If you remember, I can't remember when we went through this, but we talked about the Seleucids in Syria. We talked about the Ptolemies in Egypt. If you remember, I talked about how they were both Greek city-states, basically. They were both controlled by Greeks. But what ended up happening is Israel got stuck in the middle, and that became the battlegrounds. Both of them wanted control. So the Seleucids in Syria in the north, and then the Ptolemies in the south by Egypt, they just kept going back and forth through Israel, fighting each other, trying to get control, trying to dominate. With archaeology, it's been neat because they've discovered a lot of coins, a lot of money. Some of the money has Ptolemies on it. Some of it has the Seleucids. Because depending on who had control, they'd push down past that line. Their money would come down. It gets traded. It gets dropped. It gets buried. Whatever it may be. But it went back and forth. And they had this struggle between Egypt and Syria. And so they continued to fight for those territories. So that's kind of when we think about that area and how that works. So the Egypt, as this fighting goes on, as you have this Greek rule, one of the most well-known Egyptian rulers is Cleopatra. Cleopatra was not Egyptian. She was Greek. She was one of the last Greek rulers. Now, when you look at pictures of her, she looks very Greek, right? She dressed Greek. Why? Say it loud. She's Greek, but why would she look like an Egyptian? Why do you think she'd want to be viewed as Egyptian? Because she dressed Egyptian, she'd act Egyptian, they'd incorporated a lot of Egyptian culture. Legitimacy of her power. What did they view them as? Gods. She wanted to be treated like a god. She wanted to be respected as a god. And so she looked like Egyptian. But what happened is, because it was Greek, it had been ruled by the Greeks for quite some time, they did pick up a lot of the Greek culture. And to some point, at one point down the line, Egypt became more Greek than anywhere else. We have the Alexandrian Library. And so we see how Greek culture and Greek philosophy kind of takes over. It's kind of this powerhouse that not only are they battling themselves, but it's spreading, right? They have so much control at that point. A lot of Cleopatra's predecessors were Greek. They weren't Egyptian. And so we see this legacy there. And so you get this Greek and Egyptian culture mixed, but it ends up having a really big impact in that area. So it ends up happening. The Romans overthrow the Greeks in 63 BC. And there's a couple of people that we want to take note. Herod the Great is one of them. You'll know him because he's mentioned in the Bible, but he's not a good person. He's basically known as a tyrant, right? He's a tyrant that has a lot of power. Did the Romans throw him out? Nope, they liked him because he was a tyrant. He had a lot of control. He managed things well, and they go, "We like your style. We're going to leave you in power. We like how you handle things." And so he had this domineering personality, and so they had left him in control of kind of Syria, the Jordan, Galilee area. That's kind of the big impact that he had. They left him as the ruler over those. One of the things that he liked to do was he was a builder. He was an enormous builder. A couple of things. One of them was the Caesarea Harbor. If you've never heard of the Caesarea Harbor, it is a man-made harbor in that area. And what it ended up doing is it opened up another access point for them to have goods brought in. So they no longer had to only caravan goods in, supplies. By building this harbor, what it did, there was an absolute, basically, wealth exploded in that area. Commerce exploded because now they had another access point. And the ships could now come in. It was much easier to do a lot of the trading, all because he had this harbor built. Now, another thing that he did, he was the one that led the remodeling of Zerubbabel's temple. When we think about Christ and the apostles, when they would have gone to the temple, that wasn't just the plain old Zerubbabel's temple. This was a remodeled, revamped. He amped it up. He beautified it. I don't know if that's really a word. Sounds like a word. We're going to go with it. Beautified. Beautification. He made it a whole lot better than it was. He redeveloped, not redeveloped it, but he basically made it into one of the major wonders of the world at that time because of this remodeling of the temple there. One of the other things that he's famous for, I said it even impacts us today, he had the fortress Masada built. Now, if you think about the Jewish revolt in 70 AD, this is where they thought they were going to overthrow the Romans. They had no idea what they were actually stepping into. They had no idea how big Rome really was. And so what happened, he had this, I was going to put it up, but I ended up running out of time. At some point, look up Masada, M-A-S-A-D-A. This is the Masada Fortress. He had this built up on this mountain, and the only way to get up to it, originally, it was basically a single file line, a little stair step that zigzags all the way up this mountain. And so what ended up happening when the Jewish revolt, when they realized they were going to lose, everybody who was left fighting of the Jews, they retreated up to Masada. And so they retreat back to Masada. The Romans couldn't get them. As a single file line, they couldn't get up this mountain into this fortress to take it over. And so Romans being Roman, what they do, they brought in somewhere between 5,000 and 8,000 men, and they said, we're going to build a ramp. We'll build a ramp up to you. We can't get up to you, but we'll build a ramp. So they ended up, they first built a 2.5 mile long wall to kind of protect themselves, and then they built a ramp up to Masada. And so they took the time to build all of this, to get up there. And anybody know what happened? They took all of this time, all this manpower, they get up there, and there's this big battle. Nope. Jews committed suicide. The zealots that were retreated, there's reports that the only survivors that they think were there, they were, I think, two women and five children. They kind of hid themselves, and that's why they know what happened. What it was is basically they elected 10 men to kill everybody else, and then those 10 men drew straws, and one of them killed the other 10 and then killed themselves. They committed mass suicide. Instead of giving up, or instead of being taken over by the Romans, they committed mass suicide. Now that's not the end of Masada. Masada still is important today because even though they lost at that point, for modern Israel, oftentimes they still take the recruits. So Israel has mandatory military service. When you turn 18, you have to dedicate a certain number of years to the military. And what they often do is they will go up and they will swear their allegiance to Israel at Masada. They'll give them a Bible, and they'll give them a gun, and they basically swear that Masada will never fall again. That's why the Israeli army fights so hard. They have this dedication, they have this desire, they have this drive that they will not commit mass suicide again, but they will fight till the last man is standing. They will never give up like they did again. And so we have this impact of what Herod the Great left, his legacy. It is still impactful today because Israel stands behind what that meant. what the symbolism is for them, the impact of this fight of getting rid of that empire, getting rid of that Roman Empire that they were held captive to. Because that's what they rejected. They rejected that captivity. And so Herod the Great's Masada is still part of our society today, a part of Israeli culture, Israeli history. So when you think about all of what takes place, and I kind of opened this up today in saying, when we think about those first century Jews, that they would have been very unified, right? They have to be to build so many revolts against Rome, and they would have to be unified. But they weren't. They were very segregated at times. There were all kinds of Jewish groups, and they always argued with each other. And that's what we see in the Bible. That's their culture. That's why all these rabbis walked around with different groups, and they'd have these debates. They'd have these debates about who was right and who was wrong. And so when you think about it, a couple of the groups, we have the Pharisees. The Pharisees were very strict with the interpretation of the Torah and the oral law. There were a lot of the Pharisees who did join the early Christian church. They were part of that movement. When we think about that, we see that as some of the spurring of the problem in that early church, is because when they came along, when they joined the church, when they understood enough to know who Christ was, they didn't always forget their, I want to say lineage, but they didn't forget their customs, their traditions. And so as they came in, they brought some of their Pharisaical arguments in with them. That's why we see, as the Pharisees come in, they're going, hey, you guys have to be circumcised. And they're going, wait, no. Gentiles don't have to be circumcised. And they're going, no, I can show you in the Bible where they have to be circumcised. And so they didn't quite grasp and they didn't quite understand. They went back to the Bible and their oral law and said, I can show you in the Bible and I can show you in the oral law where you're required to be circumcised. Even you as Gentiles, to be part of this, you have to do that. To be a Christian, you have to be circumcised. And so these become some of the battles and some of the discussions that they have. The Pharisees were interesting because they don't have the long heritage that the Sadducees do. When you think about the Pharisees were an organized group. They came from those fathers that were created after they were taken into captivity at Babylon. So we don't see them in the Old Testament. They don't have a legacy in the Old Testament. They weren't part of the Levites. What they ended up doing, the Pharisees came along, they started creating all these new laws, they started protecting the law, and they go, hang on, you guys aren't doing a good enough job. You're not doing it right. We're going to take over. So we don't find them in the Bible, but we see them taking power. They're demanding power. They weren't ordained by God. They simply formed a group, formed their party, and said, we're going to do it better than you. We're going to follow God better than you do. And so that leads us to the Sadducees. The Sadducees were generally, they were mainly priests. They came from wealthy families. They're the ones that we basically see as the ordained group that come out. And they're the ones fighting with the Pharisees going, no, you can't be in charge. We were ordained. You weren't ordained. And so there's this battle back and forth. But the Pharisees had drawn so much power at this point that they're almost on an even playing field. Which is why we see the struggle between the Pharisees and Sadducees and the discussions that they have. I even mentioned, I think last time we did this, about how sometimes they would play them against each other because they didn't align with their beliefs. And so when they figured out they were, the Sadducees didn't believe in a spirit realm, they didn't believe in resurrections. And so at times the apostles would go, well, hang on a second. I'm talking about this resurrection of the Christ. And then the Pharisee would go, oh, yeah, we believe that. And he'd go, yeah, but they don't. And so then they'd start arguing. And he'd play them against each other. And so they could use that against them. And so these Sadducees would fight with there's kind of this balance of power between the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And that's why they were always arguing. We see the ox in the ditch come out with the argument with the Sadducees and Pharisees. And so there's always this debate going back and forth of how to handle certain situations, these extreme situations. But they always argued. They always fought over things. We have the Herodians. The Herodians were a political party. They came, their name says it, they came from the family of Herod. They weren't really a religious party. They were more political than anything. We have the Zealots. The Zealots were a religious political party. They were the ones that believed that they had to set the stage for the Messiah to come. They were the ones always prodding the Romans. Anytime there were these little, basically, revolts, it was them starting the rebellions. They were saying, we have to create this environment for the Messiah to return. And so they were constantly picking at and attacking the Roman soldiers. That was the Zealots. And so the Zealots were the ones that ended up at Masada. They were that final group. And then we have Essenes. Essenes aren't mentioned anywhere in the Bible. The Essenes were seen as probably the strictest of the religious groups. They stuck very heavily to the law of what they could. They believe that some of the Essenes may have been with the Zealots when Masada was taken over. But we see how there's a whole bunch of different groups. This isn't everybody's aligned, everybody's on the same page. It's why there's so much chaos. And it's why nobody ever wanted to rule. None of the Romans wanted to go here. They knew it was just a boiling pot, ready to explode at any time. They had to be on their toes all the time because all of these groups, they never saw eye to eye. They all had different ideas of what needed to happen, when it needed to happen, how it needed to happen, what their beliefs actually were. And so it was always stirring up. It was always creating problems. And the Romans had a really hard time of managing this. And they tried at times to manipulate and twist because the Romans didn't want to just take over all the rule. The Romans would usually let groups control their own stuff until they thought there was a point that they were losing control, that they were going a different direction. And that's what they dealt with the Jews, is they couldn't let them fully govern themselves. There was always a Roman governor. One of the things that the Romans did allow was they allowed them to have the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin was a 70 members, and then they had the high priest who was basically the, not just chair, but the tiebreaker. Because anytime they had debates, if it was 35 on 35, the high priest would make the final decision. But yes, they held the highest spot, right? They kind of had the highest position at that point. The Romans allowed this, and they left it. But the thing is, there were times where the Romans didn't like the high priest. And maybe the decisions that they were making, maybe, I don't know what all went into it, but there were times that they go, we don't really like this guy. Yeah, Mindy? So this is where we get into this mixture of both. Okay. At this point, you have a conglomerate. And part of that is going into what I'm getting ready to say is because what would happen is the Romans didn't like some of the ones that were in charge, but they couldn't ever remove the high priest. The Jews knew that they didn't have control to do that. But what they would do is they would add new high priests. And so at points, we would have two or three high priests because the Romans would go, no, this person has control now. Sometimes it was based off of money. Sometimes it was based off of decisions that they liked to have. And so the Romans just started adding people in when they didn't like it because they didn't have the power to remove them. They knew it would cause problems if they tried to remove those people from positions. And so you get this weird, now you have this weird dynamic because this role that God had ordained, right? God had this specific position of high priest who was supposed to guide, right? The high priest with Israel was the only one allowed to go into the Holy of Holies one time a year. So this was a position of power. Like Brian said, it was kind of that high chair, that high position. And the Romans just start kind of just tossing them in there going, oh, we like the way you think. Okay, we're going to put you in because we don't feel like we have control anymore. And so it became this really weird dynamic of you could almost buy positions. You could buy your seat into some of these spots because of the power and the control that the Romans had at that point. Does that help? Yeah, it becomes this really weird dynamic. It's not what God designed by any means. But we see that the Romans didn't just turn over control. They never fully relinquished all of their control that they had. And it stirs up a lot of different challenges and trouble because you no longer had one person to look to. Now you have multiple people who are saying, I have this authority, I have this power to speak for God, when it was really the Romans putting them into that position based off of how much money they could give them. And so it becomes a challenge, and the Romans stepped into something they really had no idea what they were getting into. I think they found out later on of this trouble that they caused, but I don't know that they even cared. And so what we see is even with them doing this, the Jews continued to revolt. They continued to rebel. And that's where we see Pontius Pilate being sent in. He was sent along with, they think, 5,000 to 6,000 soldiers. And he was basically telling the Jews, all right, this is how it's going to work. You guys either fall in line or our 5,000 men can beat your 10,000 men any day. Like, our army is designed to destroy everybody. They didn't care how many. They go, we're better trained than you. We're better tactful. We have better tactics than you. They go, we can handle you. And so that they established this. And that's what Pontius Pilate showed up with, is this basically fall in line or we'll crush you. And that's what we see a lot of times is this mentality. The last thing I want to mention today, I'm going to give you a little bit of homework, because one of the really cool things that we find about history of this time, it wasn't done in this time, but in 1947 there was a discovery in some of the caves in Qumran. Anybody know what was there? Some of you have taken trips over there, so I know. The scrolls, right? The Dead Sea Scrolls. These are some of the most valuable things for us as far as the validity of the Bible. The Dead Sea Scrolls have an impact on a whole nother level. During the sermon, I talked about us just having faith, right? Blind faith. We never have just blind faith. We have proof of things that we believe in, that we trust in, and our faith goes along with that. These scrolls, it was basically, there was a young boy, they say, that threw a rock into one of these caves, heard pottery break. And when they went to figure out what it was, they found a whole bunch of these scrolls, which turns out to be the Bible. What's really interesting is that when we start looking at these older manuscripts, because remember, they didn't photocopy these, right? They hand wrote these. They copied them year after year, however long it took those parchment papers to wear out, they copied them over and over again. But they were stored and kept. And what we find is, even though these were passed on through handwritten parchments, when we look at the text of the Bible and we match it up with those manuscripts, they're almost perfectly spot on. Now, there's a few times where there's spelling mistakes. There's a few times that they look at words that we don't know how to translate. But for the majority of it, we see the ancient manuscripts as having a large amount of validity because it verifies the Bible. That's what I want you to look at. Research the Dead Sea Scrolls to see how impactful that is for what we believe today. Because it's not a blind faith. We don't have just hope and faith that everything works out. We have proof. We have validity to what we believe and why we believe that this is the inspired Word of God. Now, we have to be careful, because over the years there have been people who have added things, or James is a good spot to where we go to and say, hey, look at this note down here. This whole section has been added to prove the Trinity. So we have to be careful with what we take, but when we go back to manuscripts and we match it up, it matches pretty close, word for word. And so that's what I want to leave you with today. I was going to try to keep it a little bit shorter. I think I did. Can't remember where we started, but that's what, as we talk about early church history, like I said, if you guys have questions, feel free to email me or text me, or you can research it and then tell me I'm wrong. Because that happens sometimes. But that's all I had for today.